you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and it's that time of year again. It's Christmas, which means every year we have to have my favorite Christmas guest, Christmas Franklin. Hi, Christmas.
Ho, ho, ho. Hey, Rob.
Glad to have you back on the show. It's again, of course, Chris has been on the show every year in the last couple when we've been doing a Christmas show. And the first two Christmas shows were DC books. Mm-hmm. But now we've moved on to Marvel. We're moving across the street, and we are covering Marvel Treasury Edition number 13, the Giant Superhero Holiday Grab Bag. And it is truly a grab bag, but we'll get to that in a moment. It originally was released on November 16th, 1976, features a wonderful cover by Gil Kane and Joe Sinnott, and we've got Thor using Hulk as a reindeer, which is weird, and you've got the Thing dressed as Santa, plus you've got Spider-Man and Iron Man flowing in a nice Christmassy, snowy winter New York setting. What did you think of this cover, Chris?
I think it's a great cover. I love it. It's you know, it's very dynamic. You know, Gil Kane does graceful flight like nobody's business, you know, and it's a really, really nicely composed, of course. And you had sent me the original sketch.
Right, that sketch exists. Thanks to my friend, I need to mention my friend Alexander Johnson, who is a big collector of original Treasury art. He finds this stuff for me, and he sent me, the original Gil Kane cover sketch, which you'll see on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Did you notice something different in that sketch that's not on the cover?
What did I miss? I don't have it directly in front of me, so what did I miss?
One of the featured characters who has a story was in the sketch, and he's not on the cover, Daredevil.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay, yeah, he's not here on the cover. That is weird.
He's not even on the back cover. They didn't even
move the back.
Because there's the Avengers and the Silver Surfer are on the back cover, some of the other Avengers. And, there's no Daredevil, and he's got one of the featured stories. So
Daredevil's having a rough week
as we record this because he got canceled on Netflix.
I think
he got killed in the comics right now.
Poor Matt. That's so unfortunate. Yeah, that's funny. Maybe it was meant to be another story, and they slotted Daredevil one in at the last second, and they didn't bother to change the cover or anything like that. That's weird.
It's weird, yeah. Okay. It is strange, yeah.
Anyway, yeah, it's a very nice cover. It's very festive. Marvel was always very comfortable with sort of having all their characters do these kind of goofy things and having them in the Christmas. And for whatever reason, it seems like Ben Grimm was usually the one dressed as Santa. I've seen that in more than one image. They seem to pick him as the guy that was always dressed up as Santa. I guess he had that sort of avuncular feeling to him. So they felt comfortable making him the guy with the beard and the coat and everything else.
Yeah, I seem to recall a subscription ad that had...
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, dressed as Santa Claus. Yeah. So he's big and cuddly, even though he's Rocky.
Alicia Masters would agree. So
right.
On the inside cover, we've got some Christmas ornaments hanging up, and we see all the various characters. It's funny to see Ghost Rider. Yeah, this sort of demonic image on a Christmas tree ornament, but there he is. It's cute. It's got the Hulk and Spider-Man. It's pretty much everybody that's going to feature into this book, and then the next 80 pages or so. So the opening story actually is original. This is original content to the Treasury. It's called "Tis the Season," and it's written by Roger Stern, George Tuska, and Don Perlin. And it's on a wintry day in New York. The Fantastic Four are engaging in a snowball fight with the Avengers as part of a charity event. The Thing gets a good one in on the Beast, but then gets a tree full of snow dunked on him by the newly arrived Spider-Man. At first, the Thing is mad, but then realizes it wouldn't look good to the onlookers for him to get so mad at the wall crawler. So he slaps Spidey on the back and then remembers one of their previous adventures. Cue harp music.
And that takes us into In Those Who Will Not See from Marvel Team-Up number 6, January 1973, with Jerry Conway as a scripter, Gil Kane artist, Mike Esposito inker, Gene Izzo letterer, and Roy Thomas was the editor. Spider-Man breaks into the Baxter Building, and the Thing is none too happy about it. But Spidey has a reason for violating the Fantastic Four's surprisingly lax security. He brings with him the unconscious form of the FF's old foe, the Puppet Master, whom he and the Vision had defeated in the last issue of Marvel Team-Up. Ben shakes his enemy awake, but his girlfriend Alicia Masters intervenes on behalf of her twisted but still beloved stepfather. She fills Spidey in on her family drama while Ben takes the tiny bald man into another room and apparently roughs him up some. Ben persuades PM to tell him that Alicia's blindness may not be permanent after all. This not quite conventional four hop in the Fantastic Car and head for the western hills of Pennsylvania. On the way there, Puppet Master relates the reason for their destination. There he once had a laboratory with his partner, Jacob Riis. As the two worked on developing a strange radioactive clay, as you do, the Puppet Master-to-be, who is never named in this story, grew jealous of Riis and his loving wife and daughter. His obsession with Reese's wife led him to sabotage their experiments, and when Riis found him, the two became engaged in a battle that left Riis dead. The lab exploded due to Puppet Master's tampering, and Alicia was blinded by the radioactive clay. Never knowing the full story, Riis's widowed wife married the Puppet Master. He confesses that when his wife died, something inside him snapped. That is when he began to use clay to mold figures with which he could control the real thing. When the Fantastic Car lands near the site of the destroyed lab, Ben tells his potential father-in-law to start looking for it, hoping Alicia's cure awaits them. Leaving Alicia in the Fantastic Car, Ben, Spidey, and Puppet Master search for the entrance, but instead find a laser cannon which pops out of the ground. Puppet Master jumps inside the doors, and Spidey and the Thing soon follow behind him. Knowing that they've been duped, the two heroes split up to search for their squirrely foe. They are unaware that he has made his way to his partner, the Mad Thinker, who ponders if it was a mistake to set up a base in the Puppet Master's old lab. Being the weasel that he is, Puppet Master convinces the Thinker that he has a rare opportunity to observe or destroy the heroes. So while watching on his monitors, he traps Spider-Man in an oiled chamber he can't cling to, and the wall crawler begins to fall to his death. He leads the Thing to an armored room and sucks the air out with a powerful vacuum, suffocating him. The Mad Thinker then sends his android to retrieve Alicia. As Spidey figures out, he can bounce back and forth between the walls to slow his descent. He then finds the lower part of the wall isn't slick and stops right above a huge set of spikes. Mad Thinker and Puppet Master are too busy observing Alicia's predicament to notice, and Puppet Master gets riled when he sees Alicia in danger. After the Mad Thinker pimp slaps him, he starts to retaliate with a blow from a wrench, but chickens out. Luckily, Spidey's webs make the blunt object connect with the Thinker's overrated noggin. Outside, Ben shows up in time to save his lady love from the advancing android. The two get in a typical clobber knocker, with Ben triumphantly knocking him into the nearby lake with a dead tree. When Spidey arrives on the scene, Ben explains he just got mad enough to bust out of his trap. The tunnel to the lab explodes, and Ben wonders why one of the villains would blow it up. Alicia believes it was the only way her stepfather could say how sorry he was for all he had done. So what do you think of this one, Rob?
Oh, I love it. I have not read a lot of the really early Marvel team-ups, and I think probably the only ones I have read are the ones that are reprinted in Treasuries. There's like the Marvel team-up number 4 with the X-Men from Marvel Treasury number 18, which I already covered way back. But as drawn by Gil Kane, who was perfect for these, and Jerry Conway, who we all know, we all love, like, they're just so much fun, you know, because it's Spider-Man and then a random character and then some random villains, and it's like full of death traps. I mean, I love the whole thing of Spidey falling down the chamber that's all slick, so we can't. It's just, I don't know. To me, this is like straightforward superhero adventure, and Gil Kane is just one of my favorites. It all depends on who's inking him. Like, I think Mike Esposito is okay. I've seen some other inkers that I like him a lot better, but Gil Kane's layouts and his storytelling are just so beautiful. He's perfect for this kind of stuff, and I love that sequence of him grabbing the Puppet Master and like shaking him to his face, like getting up in his face. Like, I love all that. So I really enjoyed the story. I thought it was just a blast.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And like, you straight superhero action is a good way to describe it, but it does have those Marvel pathos in it. I mean, you've got the whole Puppet Master backstory, and I think this might be the first time that all this was revealed. So I don't think we ever knew this before, this story, as I recall. So, and it's actually a pretty interesting backstory, and Jerry does a really good job of establishing that the Puppet Master is just this really kind of weaselly kind of guy. I mean, he's so – I mean, I keep using the word weasel, but he's just – he's like so jealous of his partner that he just gets obsessed enough with him to destroy their work. And he's got the hots for his wife. And as soon as the guy's dead, he moves in on the wife, even though he led to the, he didn't directly kill his partner. In the fight, he hit his head on like a girder or something. And that's what killed him. Then of course he was blown up in it too, but he didn't like murder him, but you know, he died in the fight they were having. So this guy's like pretty loathsome really, you know, but he's, mm-hmm. he's like, mm-hmm. he realizes he's like scummy, you know, which is, mm-hmm. you know, he's like, he's not really repentant, but he's reflecting on, you know, how bad he is, which is interesting. You don't see that from supervillains a lot, you know?
Right.
And you know, he's even, you know, he gets his hands dirty with the clay, but he doesn't want to like hit the mad thinker with a wrench. He's just too much of a chicken, you know? And so Spider-Man has to like knock the wrench into the, with the web, which, you know, could have killed the guy, honestly, but hey, you know, it's, but yeah, the art, I really like the dynamic layout and the action that Gil Kane, you know, puts forth in all these. I've got like the Essential Marvel Team Up Volume 1, which is a lot of Gil Kane, from this era, and Ross Andrew, and it's really fun stuff. And the only thing is there's a few panels here and there where, man, Spider-Man's eyes are just weird looking. There's one where he's talking to Alicia, and it's like, oh wow, it's on panel 5 of page 8 of the Treasury, and wow, it's really like, I don't even see how he could see out of the eye holes of that mask. It's really strange, but that might
be, right there, they're super thin. Yeah,
yeah, that might be Mike Esposito inking him, and I know Gil Kane often drew very loose. Well, look at that cover sketch, you know, and I've seen a lot of times that's his finished, you know, pencils, and somebody will come back and behind him and ink him. So he might have left a lot open to interpretation and expected, you know, somebody to kind of handle it that knew what they were doing, because John Romita usually inked him on Amazing Spider-Man, so. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously you've got the Spider Master there to cover you with the details of his costume. But yeah, I mean, but no, this is fun. I mean, the Mad Thinker is kind of one of those villains. I know on the Fantastic Cast, every time he shows up, they're like, oh, it's the Mad Thinker. He's like one of the nobody's favorite villain. But at the same time, it makes perfect sense for those two to work together. So, I mean, it was kind of a that's the fun of these, like you said. It's mixing the characters and the villains, like from different series. And, of course,
right.
Mad Thinker and Puppet Master are both Thing villains because they're Fantastic Four villains. But still, you know, it's like what we all keep saying about if Marvel would just do like a Marvel team-up movie series or something, you know. Mm-hmm, so you could just pull the characters and villains so you could see like the different villains fight the different characters. And I mean, it's something we just don't get in comics, because nobody, they've tried to do team up books and they just don't last. And although this one, I mean, obviously this isn't really, you're dropped in the middle of a story to some point, because, you know, Spidey brought Puppet Master over to the Baxter Building from the previous issue. So, you know, this is a serialized story still, even though it's a team up book, which is, you know, usually DC's like Brave and the Bolds didn't continue from one issue to the next. There weren't story threads that continued on, but you know, here we got one and it works, although you kind of wonder, why didn't Spidey just take him to prison, you know, take him to the police, or leave him webbed up outside of a police station or something? But no, he breaks into the Baxter Building, as Spider-Man is wont to do. We know from like Amazing Spider-Man number 1, Spider-Man started breaking into the Baxter Building.
Yeah, right from the very beginning of their relationship. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and it's kind of, you know, it's got that little bit of character depth, and Jerry was writing like everything at Marvel at the time. So
he sure was. Yeah,
I mean, he was a workhorse, and we're going to get more Jerry Conway later on in this issue. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And said, you're right. It is part of a continued story, but it tells enough of a story that has a beginning, middle, and end that I think it's fine. You know, it's not like it ends midway through where you're like, oh, I didn't get an ending. No, this does have an ending. It's just, it's a chapter in a longer story, but at least it does tell somewhat of a you know, like, okay, I understand what's going on, I understand the motivations, and that's what Marvel was so good at. You know, they gave you something that was part of a larger mosaic, but also could just work by itself if you just happen to drop 20 cents on it off the newsstand in 1973 or whatever.
Which is why the movies are so brilliantly done, because they've recreated that in the cinema.
Exactly. Exactly. Perfect. Perfect. So, yeah, very cool. It's a very fun story. So then we go back to New York, and we're in the present, and Yellow Jacket asks Wasp if she's having a good time. Janet says she is, as she sports a very fashionable winter outfit. The Vision and Scarlet Witch arrive, which causes Janet to remember the first time they met the android. And then we move into the second story, which is the classic Even an Android Can Cry from Avengers number 58 by Roy Thomas, John Buscema, and George Klein. The being known as the Vision wishes to become an Avenger, so Captain America, Thor, and Iron Man decide to test him to see if he is worthy of joining the team. Unexpectedly and decidedly out of character, Captain America starts a fight with the Vision, with Iron Man and Thor joining in. He proves to be quite a powerful being in full command of his abilities, for he fights off the three Avengers to a standstill, probes his computer brain to see if he can recall how he came to be. We flash back to see that the Vision was created by Ultron to destroy the Avengers, but Ultron's creation turned on him, instead teaming with the Avengers to defeat the mad Ultron. Goliath remarks that the Vision's android form is similar to an experiment he was working on, and the team decides to head for Hank Pym's lab out in the suburbs. Goliath can't recall what happened to his lab and why is it now in ruins, abandoned. Pym subjects himself to one of his machines that will help recall his memories, and in another flashback we learn that Ultron is the creation of Pym, who also turned on its creator but used its advanced powers to erase Pym's memory of everything that happened. Iron Man explains a further connection, which is the story of Wonder Man, a superpowered rival of Tony Stark's who was sent to join the Avengers as a secret spy for Baron Zemo. When Wonder Man learned Zemo wanted to kill the Avengers, not just imprison them, Wonder Man turned and helped rescue the Avengers, dying in the process. Goliath, however, preserved his brain patterns to one day be put in the form of another being, which turned out to be the Vision. With all their questions answered, the Avengers welcome Vision to the team. He thanks them for their friendship, but then quickly departs so he can be alone where he sheds a tear. Well, I mean, I don't know, Chris. Do we even have to go over this one? I mean, this is like one of the iconic stories of Marvel in the 60s. And what do you think of it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is undoubtedly the most famous story in the book. And I mean, and it deserves all the accolades it gets. I mean, it's late Silver Age Marvel at its best. I mean, it's... Yeah, it's got some of that comic book wonkiness that we all love, but I mean, it's a pretty poignant story for you know, a 15 cent comic book. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's asking a lot of questions about what makes a human and you know, even the soul and you know, things like that. I mean, they'll get even further into that with the Vision, but it all starts here, you know. And man, there's a lot of stuff packed in here, but.
Oh my God! I'm writing the synopsis. I was like, wait, who? Well, okay, what? Like, it was so complicated. And this is like 21 pages. Like, Roy Thomas jammed a lot of stuff here.
This is like something that most comics would say for an anniversary issue, where they tie in all these threads from the past, and it's double sized. But this is a regular sized comic, and it's just a random, you know, number of you know, it's not the issue number 100 or anything, but you got
right.
You're calling back to Wonder Man and Baron Zemo and Masters of Evil and all that stuff. So I mean, it's like, wow, you know, they pack so much in here. It's just and the John Buscema art is just I love it. I mean, I know he didn't like to draw superheroes, but man, you can never tell it. I mean, it's...
I know. I can never get over that. Knowing that he didn't think superheroes were like, he would just, if he could have, he just would draw Conan his whole life.
Right.
The fact that this stuff is so good looking, I'm like, boy, that's a professional. You know, I mean, you're an artist, I'm an artist. We've all had gigs where you're like, ugh, let me just get through this. But you never get that sense from Buscema's work, because there are so many iconic shots of the Avengers here that you could just take one of these panels and turn it into a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Because it's oh my God, this stuff is so beautiful to look at. It's
yeah, it
unbelievable.
Is. It's just in his anatomy. And I mean, his figures are a little leaner than he'll kind of draw some of them later, I think, because this is early on. But yeah, it's just... I mean, yeah, it's well, the dude drew How to Draw Comics the Marvel Way. I mean, he would stand. I mean, so, I mean, this is how you draw comics the Marvel Way. Short of Jack Kirby, this is it, you know. And it's just fantastic. And George Klein, I always think of him as Kurt Swan's inker. I don't think that he went over to Marvel there at the end of the 60s. I think shortly before he passed away. And I really like his inks over Buscema here. It looks it's a nice combo. I mean, he kind of he doesn't detract from it at all. He kind of enhances what he's doing. So I mean, it's a really nice combination. The layouts are great in that last page of the Vision with the, you know, and the Treasury size, just that full page, you know, torso shot of him with the tear running down his face. And I mean, that there is just that's a poster, you know, I mean, you just cut it out and stick it on your wall. I mean, it's just awesome. This is, it deserves every praise it gets, I think.
Yeah. I love that. In that page you're talking about, that the background is black and white.
Yes.
Like, that's just a nice effect. That's just something that, and I don't know whether that's the colorist note, or that was Buscema who said, you know, drop the color or whatever. In the splash page is great too, of the Black Panther, on the brick wall where you've got the title of the story. It's just, they reprinted this in the Black Panther Digest, which Shag and I covered over on Digest, which is funny because this is so not a Black Panther story.
No.
It opens with Black Panther, and then he drops into Avengers Mansion, and then he's basically out of the story at that point. So they were cheating a little and making this a Black Panther story. One other note I do have, I love that the original design of Ultron, he looks like a trash can.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that one of the most fearsome villains in all of Marvel's history looks like somebody you would just dump your trash into. It's just so not fearsome. It's really funny to me.
Yeah, I mean, the gonk droid from Star Wars is more intimidating looking than this guy, you know? I mean, it's really kind of – yeah, I mean, in the Ultron, when they show Ultron, I mean, he's already pretty much got the classic Ultron design. I mean, they modified it and stuff, but, I mean, you recognize that. Oh, yeah, there's – when he's, you know, talking about when he created the Vision's flashing back. He's got the mouth, he's got the evil eyes and everything. He looks like Ultron we know, but yeah, the proto Ultron. Whoa, not scary. Yeah, I'm not trying to pick on it, but he looks like something out of the Silver Age Superman comic, you know, versus the what we're getting here. So yeah, it's yeah, good. Yeah, thank goodness they changed that design.
Yeah, it's really goofy. So anyway, yeah, it's a true classic. So then after that, we go back to the present, back in New York City, and Captain America thanks the crowd for attending this charity event, asking everyone to return next year. While Vision and Scarlet Witch walk home, Wanda sees a shooting star. What she doesn't realize is that the gleam in the sky isn't a shooting star. It's the Silver Surfer. The Surfer glides over New York City, taking notice of humanity engaging in holiday activities. Far below, through a window, he is spotted by the Incredible Hulk, who remarks that, at one time, the Surfer was his friend. And then we go into the third story, He Who Strikes the Hulk, from Tales to Astonish number 93 by Stan Lee, Marie Severin, and Frank Giacoya. The Hulk, thinking that the Silver Surfer was an alien spaceship, has forced the Surfer to land. Now the Hulk has demanded that the Surfer take him away from Earth to find a new home where he won't be hounded. Unaware that the Surfer is unable to leave Earth, the Hulk attacks when the Surfer refuses to help him. The two end up in a fight, because of course they do. The Hulk is trying to gain control of the Surfer's board. However, the attempt is futile, and while the Hulk is durable enough to withstand Surfer's attacks, nothing he can do to get the Surfer's board to follow his commands. The police soon show up as the Silver Surfer makes his escape and try to keep the Hulk at bay with flamethrowers until the military arrives. Feeling pity towards the Hulk, the Silver Surfer frees him, but when he once again tells the Hulk he cannot bring him out to space, the Hulk attacks him in a fury. This time, the battle ends with the Hulk being knocked unconscious. Using his power cosmic to probe the Hulk's mind, he learns of Banner's curse. Attempting to use the power cosmic to cure the Hulk, the Hulk awakens and believes that the Surfer is attacking him and fights him off, forcing the Surfer to flee. The Hulk, once more alone, realizes that his rage prevented him from leaving the Earth. All right, Chris, what do you think of this one?
Oh, this is another classic, and I'm glad we're covering a Stan story. We all know we just lost Stan Lee, of course. And he often said the Silver Surfer was his favorite character to write, because he could just wax philosophical endlessly with the character. And, I mean, that's evident here. I mean, he's like a living, breathing Stan soapbox in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And it's great. I mean, he's got some great dialogue, and, you know, his observations about humanity are great. And with him and the Hulk, I can both see why they want to leave the planet sometimes. But, you know.
Yeah, really, seriously.
Yeah, but – but yeah, I mean, it's and we have the Marie Severin, who just passed away not too long ago as well, and I don't think she gets enough praise. I mean, I know she does within comic circles, but I wish she was more of a name amongst fans, because this is like super solid stuff. I mean, it's very Marvel. It's got some Kirby riffs, but it's not aping Kirby. And there's a slightly more grounded illustrated feel to it, which I really like. And I know she did a lot of Hulk, and of course she did a lot of coloring for EC and Marvel and a lot of production work at Marvel. And I just think this is a real good showcase for both her and Stan. And so I'm really glad I'm really glad this was in there and we could talk about it, because I really enjoyed reading this one.
Yeah, I agree. Kind of like the Marvel team up in that it's a chapter of a larger story. And I first read all these stories in a paperback. There was a Pocketbooks Hulk paperback, which reprinted all the Tales to Astonish stories. And someday I have to do a Find Your Joy on that one, because I still have that book. I bought it at a book fair in like second grade, and I still have the same copy. I read it to death. And yeah, this is a really, really fun story. I totally agree with you about Marie Severin. I really like her work. And she was somebody who could kind of dial up the cartoony and then dial it down, because of course she did all that stuff for Not Brand X.
Yeah.
So she could do straight ahead superhero stuff like this, and then do Forbush Man.
Yeah.
So she was really, you know, she could really range her drawing skill to fit whatever she had to do. So yeah, this is a really solid story. The Hulk and the Silver Surfer are like kind of perfect mismatched characters, because of course you've got Hulk who talk like this, and then you've got Silver Surfer who, as you said, is waxing philosophic about all these deep ideas, and he just wants to kind of like understand humanity. And of course Hulk is just like, punch, you know. Like, it's these two have nothing to say to one another, so it's kind of a perfect thing. So yeah, I'm glad it's a fun story. It really is.
Yeah, and I was really, I mean, I've read this before, but reading it again, it really hit me. It's like, so could the Silver Surfer have cured Banner anytime since this happened?
I know.
I'm thinking, where were you? Why didn't he just show up and do that when, like, the Hulk? Of course, I guess when the Hulk, like, in like Hulk, was it Hulk 300, when they banished the Hulk to roam the different dimensions because he was mindless. Yeah. So I guess there was no Banner left to change it back to. But all the different times when the Hulk's been really just on a rampage, the Surfer could have showed up and just cosmic zapped him and changed him back to Banner for good. It's
maybe on, and one of those multiple Defenders missions they went on together, he could have said, oh, by the way, I can cure you. You know, that might have been a good thing to come up. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, apparently, and we'll get into it, but when the Hulk's hanging around with the Defenders, he's a lot more chill, and he doesn't even turn back to Banner when he's relaxing. So
That's right. Well, let's get right to it. Said the book then cuts back to New York in the present, and the Hulk wonders aloud why he is always alone. But Doctor Strange says he isn't. The Hulk is then warmly welcomed by the Defenders, complete with Christmas presents under the tree, including presents for the Hulk. As the party commences, we see others are also celebrating, like at the offices of Nelson and Murdoch, attorneys at law. Matt Murdoch and his friend Heather go out for a walk in the snow, with Matt silently reminiscing about how he needs this bout of relaxation.
And that leads us to another time that Matt walked with a lovely lady in the snow, and the story, Once Upon a Time, The Ox, from Daredevil number 86, April 1972. Stan Lee was the editor, Jerry Conway the scripter, Gene Colan artist, Tom Palmer anchor, Artie Simic letterer. A shadowy figure watches television coverage of Daredevil's battle with some kidnappers, and then on the scene reporting from the home of wealthy Raymond Carter, who throws a party for his friends, Assistant District Attorney Matt Murdoch, and his fiancée, actress Karen Page. Lots of drama ensues at this strangely televised party. Matt and Karen have reconciled after years apart. Matt's law partner Foggy Nelson has announced he's resigning as District Attorney. Natasha Romanoff, publicly known as the Black Widow, was recently put on trial for murder, and Foggy was duped into prosecuting her. The Exposition News Network, copyright Michael Bailey, broadcast continues with news of Dr. Carl Stragg's parole from prison. Stragg was the victim of an accident resulting from experiments performed on him using pharmaceutical isotopes. With only weeks to live, Stragg was set free. Turns out our mystery couch potato, who's watching TV, is Carl Stragg himself. Kind of. See, the real Stragg mind-swapped with old Spidey and Daredevil foe the Ox. Stragg's mind died with the Ox's body, and now the Ox's mind is trapped in Stragg's dying shell. You get all that? Okay, me neither. But anyway. Anyway, the isotope experiments begin to change Stragg's body back into the Ox, and now he's huge and gray and a lot stronger. He sets out for revenge on the men who sent him to prison and down his current path, Matt Murdoch and Foggy Nelson. They are still at that party, and boy, there's a lot of soap opera drama going on. So much, the floors are probably sudsy, in fact. Anyway, Matt is worried about Foggy, and Karen is worried about falling for Matt again, since she knows he spends his nights risking his life as Daredevil. Karen's agent, Phil, still has the hots for her, even though she dumped him to go back to Matt. And Matt is still wondering about his feelings for Natasha, who is about to skip town for San Francisco with her comrade, Ivan. All the drama is interrupted by the Ox, who bursts in and smacks Foggy around. Matt's radar sense is thrown out of whack by the Ox's radioactivity, but he still swings into action as Daredevil and engages the Gray Goliath. Dee Dee can't believe this is the real Ox, which really irritates the Big Lug, who knocks Daredevil out of the window, then pummels him a bit before storming off. Surprisingly, the Black Widow doesn't lend a helping hand. Instead, she lets Karen scoop up Dee Dee's beaten body into a cab. She takes him back to his apartment and nurses his wounds. When he awakens, she's out the door to meet Phil, having second thoughts about her life plans. Daredevil swings off to find the Ox, and it doesn't take long. The giant is wrecking the town, throwing around jeeps and tanks. Daredevil figures if he can get him worked up enough, the Ox will collapse from growing too large, just like Goliath is known to do. During their battle, the Ox finally convinces his foe he is the real deal and tells him of Strag's body swap. The monster continues to grow until his pain becomes unbearable. Somehow, Strag's personality begins to reemerge. Wait, I thought he was dead. The Ox physically transforms back into Strag, and he thanks Daredevil for helping him find peace in death as his body goes critical and explodes. Later, at Matt's apartment, Karen arrives, and they both know their brief reunion is over. Their lives are headed in two different directions, costume adventurer and movie star. Now realizing they can't recapture the past, they let each other go. They say their goodbyes as Natasha pulls up. Karen gives them her blessing, and Matt wastes no time putting his arm around Natasha as they walk through the snow. So what do you think of this one?
Whew. Okay, I think the story is good. It's fine. I didn't love it. The Ox, to me, is just one of those villains. I'm like, yeah, all right, he's just kind of a big, great, dumb guy. But what I love about this one is the artwork. Gene Colan, I'm a huge mega fan of Gene Colan and Tom Palmer. But specifically, what I love is the splash page and the couple of pages that feature all the action being watched on television.
Mm-hmm.
Because Gene Colan did this duotone effect where you see these lines across the screen and everything is in black and white. And it is just really unusual. And I love looking at it. To me, it's really fun to watch a comic book try to present a television broadcast. I just think it's such a nice effect. It's such an extra level of effort that Conway and Gene Colan went to just give the story just a little bit of different visual life. So I love that splash page of Daredevil swinging over presumably Times Square because we see like a theater marquee and there's some signs there. I just love it. I think it's just, to me, I could just stare at it all day.
Yeah, I mean, it oddly gives it like an almost photorealistic quality, which is really strange.
Yeah.
But yeah, and Tom Palmer's inks, I mean, I love Gene Colan's stuff. I will say that occasionally on superhero books, I sometimes feel like if he doesn't have the right inker, that his stuff can get a little too ethereal for a superhero comic for me. So
I can see that.
So
yeah.
Tom Palmer kind of reins that in. I know he worked with him on Tomb of Dracula. I mean, you know, pretty soon they're going to be the team on Tomb of Dracula, which is fantastic artwork and in a lot of ways, Colan's masterpiece. But this is fantastic stuff. Yeah, it looks great. And I actually, even though we're dropped in the middle, this is like Jerry's been writing Daredevil for like 14 issues. I looked it up. So he is deep in all this serialized, you know, character development and relationship development and all this, you know, it's like a love. It's not even a triangle. I mean, everybody's got everybody's in love with everybody else in this story, but it works. I mean, it is kind of odd. Like I said, I joked about it that the news coverage would cover this much of the party, but who cares because the artwork's so great in that sequence. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, you really do get invested in, you know, what's going on. And yeah, the Ox is just kind of there to show Karen that, yeah, you know, Matt's not going to quit being Daredevil. He's going to have to go risk his life. And she's really just not, you know, she's not into worrying about him all the time. And which is, you know, it's kind of a trope now with superheroes who actually, you know, do get romantically involved with people. This is the thing that comes up. I can't, you know, it's like the, it's like the policeman that goes out at night or, you know, or whatever that, you know, it's, you got to be able to deal with the fact that they might not come home and that type thing. And this is probably an early instance of that. And it's put across really well, I think. I mean, it's a very mature ending for, you know, an early Bronze Age comic that these two adults just say, you know what, we're just living in the past. This is just not going to work. And they just part ways, and they part ways, you know, amicably. But unfortunately, we all know that Karen's knowledge of Daredevil's identity isn't going to turn out too good for Matt in the future.
No, no, it's not.
Oh, boy. I mean, it's, you know, the mind swapping and body swapping things kind of, I mean, I'm sure that's something Jerry's picking up from a previous, I don't know if it's a story he wrote or somebody else wrote. And that's, you know, that's the comic booky aspect of it. And I remember the Ox as being just a big bruiser guy, but he was human. He didn't have any superpowers. He was one of the enforcers with Dan and Montana from Spider-Man, you know, that worked with the big man, you know. So it's kind of interesting. He's a big gray guy, so it kind of goes back to the original version of the Hulk in a way. He's throwing tanks around and jeeps and stuff. But yeah, it's fun, and the artwork is just, like you said, is really on point. And I'm beating a horse that we keep doing on our network. But I think Ryan just said the other day in his coverage of Night Force that our buddy Paul Spataro had brought up that Gene Colan always draws characters in motion. And and he really hit the nail on the head here because, yeah, there's so much kinetic energy in these pages. I mean, even at the party, even when they're standing around, you feel like there's movement, like people are mingling amongst each other.
Yes.
Walking through the party, just like you do at a party. And like, you know, Matt has to walk past these people to get to Foggy, who's looking at the window because he's depressed because of everything that's going on. And they really put this across, not just the action, but the character interaction. And the body language, and it's just a really nice, really nice package, really well done.
Yeah. And one final thing, I love the detail at the end. You mentioned the last page with Karen and Matt, where Karen finds Matt at home, and he's sitting there, and the lights are off.
Yeah.
I just love that detail, because, of course, a blind person isn't going to put the lights on. What does he need the lights on for? I just like that detail of the extra effort to think about it and say, well, yeah, Matt doesn't put the lights on. Why would he? You know, I just like that a little bit. But yeah, it really is the artwork that puts this across. Again, nothing against Jerry. I like the story just fine. It's just, I find the artwork so compelling. And that opening splash page, again, is just so beautiful. So it's cool. It's a good, solid story. And it's something I've never read it before. I only read it in this treasure because I don't really have any of the Daredevils from this time. So anyway, back to New York City. And for the final segment, it's coming out of his reverie. Matt wonders what his old flame Natasha is doing right now. We then cut over to Los Angeles, where Black Widow and her furlough champion Ghost Rider are amazed to see snow in Los Angeles. Johnny Blaze thinks there's something nefarious afoot, and they head outside. Johnny is instantly pelted by a snowball thrown by one of the other champions, Angel, Hercules, and Iceman. Johnny and Natasha engage in the fun, and after it's over, Angel tells his pal Bobby he can, quote, turn off the snow. Iceman says he did that a while ago, meaning this snowfall is a holiday miracle. The end. So what do you think overall of like the original content here? I mean, this was something that and I kind of want to ask you about, compare these with DC, because the title of this book is a grab bag, and it is a grab bag because, of course, these four stories that are reprinted have nothing to do with Christmas.
Right.
These are just four stories. But what Marvel did was they created new material to link it. And that's something DC didn't do. DC's Christmas treasuries are Christmas stories with no new content. Marvel's are non-Christmas stories with Christmas content. And so what do you think of that comparison of the two different approaches?
Well, I think it's necessity. It's probably out of necessity. They wanted to put out a Christmas book and they basically have no Christmas stories. I mean, Marvel, right. Marvel just never did a lot of Christmas stories. And part of that's partially because they were still a fairly young company as far as superheroes go. I mean, other than their golden age and their brief return to it in the late golden age, pre-silver age, I guess atomic age you'd call it. There's not a whole lot of superhero comics for them to pull from. DC has at this point, you know, 30 years worth of material to pull from, 35 years. There's not nearly as much. And Superman and Batman, had Christmas stories every year in the 40s, pretty much, you know.
Yep.
So there's lots to pull from. And they picked it back up in the 70s. So, but yeah, you know, it's out of necessity, but I looked this up. This is Roger Stern's first writing gig for Marvel.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, it was on Mike's Amazing World, of course, where everybody goes. I looked it up there, and he had done two Charlton Bullseye stories, which was kind of that, like, internal – like fanzine that Charlton put out, you know, and he'd written two stories there, but this was his first Marvel script. And obviously Roger Stern would go on to write a lot of classic runs for Marvel, Spider-Man, the Avengers, Captain America. He was the editor on the X-Men. I mean, he did a lot at Marvel. And so this is the beginning here. So that's kind of neat. And I think it's fun. I think it's kind of a fun, you know, idea that the heroes that, and it gets all the teams together. I think that's like every Marvel team at the time represented, other than the X-Men. You know, because you've got we've got the Avengers, the FF, you've got the Defenders, and even the Champions. Wow,
I love that the Champions get worked into. They are my favorite Marvel, like, weird ass team. You know, like, it's just what a strange collection of characters. I love the Champions.
There's so much just the leftover characters. You know, it's just like
some X-Men, some Avengers. We can throw in Ghost Rider. Sure, why not?
They're the Seven Soldiers of Victory of Marvel. Yeah. <You know. laughs>
That is true. That's absolutely true.
But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I will say that, and I'm one of those people that I know George Tuska is kind of, he's not often a fan favorite. I do think he's a really good artist. I think a lot of times, I think he might be one of these types that doesn't care for superhero stuff. He just didn't seem a lot of times he drew gorgeous women for one, for the most part, but here, this seems really rushed. I mean, it's very simple. I don't know if it's Don Perlin's inks or what, but it's very open. I mean, I'm assuming he knew he was drawing for the Treasury, so you think it would, like, give him more chance to put more detail in that he knew was going to reproduce. But it's almost coloring book style art in a lot of places. It's very open and not a lot of shading, other than that last page. The last sequence with the Champions is pretty nice looking. And that last panel where they're looking at the snow, they're in shadow on that rooftop, and that's really
beautiful.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's really well done, which George Tuska can do great stuff. I mean, that DC, that comic strip he did, the World's Greatest Superheroes or whatever, that's some really sharp looking stuff, you know? And so he can, he just, like, I kind of wonder if this just wasn't like, oh crap, we need a something to connect these stories together. George, you got 2 days, you know, or something.
He's
like, oh geez, you know, okay, you know, or something. It's kind of what it looks like, you know, here. And I always like seeing, yeah, there's one panel of Captain America in particular where George Tuska, to me, I always identify as a kid. I could identify George Tuska because a lot of comic artists do this, but he really liked to draw like the teeth of a character all as one big piece. It's like this unitooth thing going on.
You know, it's like a boxer with that thing they put in.
Yeah, like a mouth guard. Yeah, it's like, you know, this everybody. Oh, there's a lot of that always going on in George Tuska's art. And there's a panel of Captain America, like I think on page 2 or something, that he does that. I'm like, oh yeah, that's George Tuska from like space. You could tell that's him. You know, so. But yeah, it's fun. I think Roger Stern does a good job of weaving in and out of the characters' memories, and I mean, this would be a hard thing to weave together, and he does a good job with it.
Right. I mean, you have to keep having these characters wander in and then have a oh, now I remember when we met the Vision, or Silver Surfer flies over and Hulk just happens to be in a building. But I do love this original content, and I love that it so firmly places all these characters in their locations, because it's mostly New York City, and then we cut to LA, of course. But the idea, and I like that, like, Captain America and the Avengers and the Fantastic Four are doing a charity drive. Like, I would pay for that. If somebody was like, hey, the Avengers and the Fantastic Four are going to have a snowball fight and you have to pay $20 for a children's charity, I'd be like, here's my $20. You know, shut up and take my money.
Right.
You know? I mean, I'd want to watch that. So it's just very fun and very festive spirity. And it's interesting that I figured that this was pretty early Roger Stern. I didn't do the research like you did to see how early. But that's interesting about how Marvel and DC would kind of train their younger writers and their younger artists by giving them backup features or kind of side stuff. And you could see, this is the perfect gig for a new writer.
Mm-hmm.
Of like, okay, you have to write 12 pages of interstitial material. So the risk is low, because if you screw it up, nobody's really going to notice. It's not like you're handing him Spider-Man.
Yeah.
You know, but, and then that gives Roger Stern a chance to prove himself. And, you know, obviously he proved himself because he went on to a great career at Marvel. But that's you could see the reasoning, an editor saying, well, here, just handle this. And if you can do this, we'll give you more.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's really fun. Again, I love the champions getting worked into it, and the idea that, like, snowing in Los Angeles is kind of a Christmas miracle. That's a fun thing. And just the idea of, like, Ghost Rider participating in Christmas festivities, that's very funny to me. Like, you know, like, what's Son of Satan doing right now?
Well, there's that weird Marvel 2-in-1 where him and the Thing, like, go back to the birth of Jesus or something with the star and all that stuff. I mean, it's really – it's like – Ghost Rider, really? It's like, yeah. And the Thing's Jewish, and it's just kind of weird, you know. It's like really strange, but it's, yeah. I've heard it covered before. I think even on Fantastic Cast they covered it, but it's but having Ghost Rider in there is it's kind of odd. He doesn't. He's Johnny Blaze in the story.
Yeah, he's never Flaming Skull Ghost Rider.
Yeah, but the Hulk, like we said, the Hulk is hanging around in the Sanctum Sanctorum. And he's not – why isn't he changing back to Banner? I mean, he's – they give him a pair of mittens and feed him, like, Christmas snack food. And he's like, what universe does the Hulk – I mean, obviously early on the Hulk changed weird, I know, like at night and blah, blah, blah. But after he was like, okay, anger and excitement triggers the change. And then when he gets calmed down, he turns back. I mean, why isn't Bruce Banner hanging out with him? I don't get it. It's just like throwing me off. It's like, what the Hulk – the Hulk's just like – he's perma-Hulk here or something. I don't know what's going on.
He's just romping around. Like, this 500-pound creature is just, you know, smashing through doorways and stuff. And they get him, I think, slippers. I mean, where did they find slippers big enough for the Hulk's feet?
Yeah.
Where did we even buy that? I guess in the Marvel Universe they have people that are build these things, because there are these characters out there. But yeah, overall, it's a really fun book. Marvel did a bunch of Christmas treasuries. And I don't know, I find this one very charming. I think the stories are all very good. There's some genuine classics in here. And then all the interstitial material is great, too. And the cover is great. So it's just a really satisfying buy. So for $1.50 in 1976, you can't beat it.
Oh, no. And we did this one. I think this is the last one they did. So we've got to go back and do the other two. So I've got to – the reason we did this one is because this is the one I have. So, right. And, of course, you've got them all. So I've got a mission between now and next Christmas to find at least one more of them. So.
Well, you know, just saying, there is an Archie Christmas treasury and there is a Flintstones Christmas treasury that Marvel Comics put out. So who knows what we'll handle next year.
Ooh, that would be fun. Yeah, both of those would be kind of fun to do. Yeah.
There you go. So everybody just have to wait a year to find out what Chris and I are going to do next Christmas. So, yeah, I think that's going to do it for Marvel Treasury Edition number 13. Chris, as always, I love having you on the show, and it's always fun to do our Christmas show. So where can people find you here on our network?
Oh, you don't have to look too far. I'm all over the place. I am on JLUcast with my wife Cindy. We discuss the Justice League animated series and Justice League Unlimited. Eventually, we're still in the Justice League phase right now. We do Supermates occasionally. We just, you know, that's more of a seasonal thing now because we're doing so much JLUcast. But we did the House of Frankenstein back in over the Halloween season. That's a lot of fun. I'm on Batman Nightcast with Ryan. I do Power Records with you, and I show up randomly here and there on the network. Is there anything? And Superman Movie Minute, of course, which is right now on hiatus, but you know that Superman 2 is looming, so
sure. Yeah. Well, very cool. Again, thank you so much for coming back on. It's always fun talking to you. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and I want you to stay tuned through these podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Coming soon from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Working together, we saved the planet. And I believe that if we stayed together as a team, we would be a force that could truly work for the ideals of peace and justice.
Every episode.
My name is Jean. I'm a Martian.
Every adventure.
Okay, you guys are so slow.
Every hero.
Whatever you think you're doing, if you present a threat to the world, the Justice League will take you down.
Cindy and Chris Franklin bring you
JLUcast.
Whatever the future holds, we'll make those choices ourselves.
Don't say you don't love me.
I'll never say that.
Covering the complete animated run of Justice League and Justice League Unlimited.
And the adventure continues.
Their strength in numbers.
What? Like a bunch of super friends?
more like a Justice League.
Hi, I'm John Wilson.
And I'm Michael Kaiser.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Make Ours Marvel. You know, here we are in 2018, 10 years into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, can you believe we live in a world where everyone's old Aunt Petunia knows who Iron Man is?
It's crazy, right?
So, to celebrate, we're on our mission to explore the roots of the Marvel Universe.
You know you've thought about it. Some of you may have even done it, and now we're going to do it too.
We're diving back into the long boxes of Marvel's history and podcasting our way through the whole universe.
All of it. Every superhero issue. And, if I can convince Mike, we'll even do Sergeant Fury.
And it's not going to be one issue per episode. That'd take forever.
It's still going to take forever.
But no, we're going to talk about as many comics as we can in an hour.
Yep, an hour and, you know, maybe a little change. Every week, Marvel Comics. So it'd be super cool if you came along for the ride.
Look for us every Friday at MakeOursMarvel.com.
That's MakeOursMarvel.com. Or on iTunes and all the other usual podcasty places.
And if you want to read along with us and send us your thoughts, we might even read emails.
So until Avengers Infinity War gets a spin-off Warlock and the Infinity Watch TV show,
Make Ours Marvel.
And we're back with listener feedback for episode 29, which was Tarzan of the Apes with my guest Brian Hyler. We don't have any new iTunes reviews. We haven't had any in a while. So, hey, everybody, for the new year, give us some iTunes reviews for our Treasure Cast. I really would appreciate it. Anyway, let's move on to the comments that we got on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. First up from my pal Chuck Coletta. He says, nice episode, guys. The Kubert art on that story is just great, and your discussion of Tarzan was informative and fun. Thank you, Chuck. There's a nice coffee table book, Tarzan, a Centennial Celebration, has a nice overview of Burroughs and his most famous creation. Highly recommended. Sounds cool. I'd like to check that out. He says, a couple of quick thoughts. The recent movie with Margot Robbie and Alexander Skarsgård was much better than I expected it to be. Pulpy in the best sense of the word. Yeah, I've been hearing a lot of good things about that movie. I gotta check that out. And then he says, The Lord of the Jungle met both Superman and Batman in miniseries from the early 2000s. I think I kind of remember seeing those, but those feel both a little like forced team ups to me, but maybe they'd be worth checking out. Anyway, thank you, Chuck. Edo Boznar says, oh man, I love Treasury Cast. I thoroughly enjoyed your discussion of, if not all things, then many things, Tarzan. I found myself nodding and smiling in agreement during so much of it. Anyway, back to the Treasury. Never had it, but it looks nice based on your gallery post. However, I have to say that even though I'm a big fan of Kubert's art, for me the definitive Tarzan comics are Marvel's, with art by the Buscema brothers. It's actually too bad that Marvel never did a Tarzan Treasury. Oh yeah. Maybe instead of one of the annuals? Seems like a no-brainer decision, since about at the same time they were printing a number of Conan Treasuries with stories drawn by John Buscema. In any case, I'm looking forward to these Tarzan Buscema years omnibus from Dynamite. That is, if it ever gets published. The release date has been pushed back 3 times in the last year and a half. According to Amazon, it'll be out this January. That sounds like a really cool book, Ito, and you'll have to let us know if they do finally publish that. Because, yeah, a Tarzan treasury of the Marvel series would have been really cool. Because, yeah, that artwork is fantastic. My pal David Gutierrez says, I love this episode. I even went to Comixology to buy some Kubert Tarzan stuff. Oh, that's awesome. Great to hear Brian and Rob with such a love of the material. Sure, Joe Kubert. It's that easy to draw like you. And what restraint by Rob? He waited almost 6 minutes before, once again, saying he attended the Joe Kubert School. We get it. You're talented. Jeez. I'm never suggesting that I'm talented. I did go to the school, but I think if you look at my assignments from that time, the word talented would not be the word that comes to mind. Anyway, thank you, David. Chris Franklin from our network says, great episode, fellas. I've always been a casual Tarzan fan, so I'm always fascinated to hear more about him. I don't have this treasury, but if I see it at a decent price, and yes, those prices fluctuate more than just about anything you'll find at a Comic-Con, I will pick it up. I watch the Filmation show regularly because, like Brian said, it was on forever. I think the last iteration was the Tarzan Lone Ranger Zorro Adventure Hour or something like that, way up in the early 80s. I don't remember much about the show, honestly, but I do remember enjoying it. Bring Brian back for the Treasury sequel or do Legend of Tarzan on film and water. Both good suggestions. Thank you, Chris. Martin Gray from Two Dangers from a Girl blog says, that was very entertaining, even for this not much of a Tarzan fan. I finished listening and rushed down to see what there was on Amazon Prime. Lots, including the silent film, which I can't wait to watch. I'm a Joe Kubert fan, but there's something awfully sad about his Tarzan. I also prefer a bit of Buscema. Another vote for John Buscema. regarding the feedback. Stop me if you've heard this, but I wrote to the Answer Man in the 70s asking how come Ghosts had the True Tales of the Weird and Supernatural subtitle when the indicia clearly indicated the stories had no relation to anyone living or dead. Wasn't I a stinker? Anyway, pretty much the same time, number 78 had the usual subtitle, number 79 had none, and number 80 brought it back, tweaked to New Tales of the Weird and Supernatural. I felt such pride. I don't remember hearing that story, Martin. That's fantastic. You probably nudged DC in a certain direction. He says, I'm hoping for more Brian on the Welcome Back Cotter episode. I never saw the show, but did enjoy the comic. Yeah, I absolutely want to do that show on the Welcome Back Cotter trilogy because it's such a weird book for DC to put out. So thank you. Siskoid from our network says, Tarzan seemed a constant in my youth. He was always on TV. While I agree that White Messiah jungle adventure stories are off-putting today, I do think the last movie addressed the character's colonial origins well and moved the character into the 21st century, so to speak. I hope to talk about Tarzan myself one day, as he's been part of a number of team-ups. That's true. Looking forward to it, Siskoid. Luke Jack and Andy says, hey guys, really enjoyed this episode. I am, as Chris said above, a casual fan of Tarzan, but I've been reading a lot of the ERB over the past 18 months or so, and I'm really enjoying it, even if my reading has been leaning more towards Pellucidar and Kaspak, the land that time forgot. Two last things. One, those Trendmasters ERB toys were great. I had the Barsoom version of Tarzan, which had removable armor. Underneath was a standard Tarzan, so he could fit in either a Martian or Terran setting. Would love to track down some more of these. Two, I agree wholeheartedly with what Brian said about The Legend of Tarzan, a superlative effort for sure, but also The Big Screen Man from U.N.C.L.E., which got little fanfare, but is completely worth your evening to watch it, an excellent and well-constructed period action film. Yeah, I've heard lots of good things about The Man from U.N.C.L.E. as well, so I have to get around to both of those, especially Legend of Tarzan. I wanted to see that in the theater, and I just didn't get around to it, but I'll have to find it on one of the 75 streaming services I subscribe to. So thank you, Luke. Gothos Mansion said, as always, I enjoyed the show. Since Rob brought up the Bo Derek Tarzan, I think that movie may have led to a decline in Tarzan's popularity. I never saw it until the early 90s on Joe Bob's Drive-In Theater. It was one of the few times Joe Bob ever apologized for the movie that he showed. As for the Treasury itself, it was very entertaining. It is only one of three Tarzan comics I have. Kubert's art was great to see at the Treasury size. I'm not that familiar with the content that Joe Bob shows. I think that stuff has to be edited, right? So I'm wondering what that version would have looked like, because it's like that movie is nothing but footage of Richard Harris wandering around the desert looking for Tarzan, and then you cut the nude scenes of Bo Derek. So if you cut all the Bo Derek stuff out, what do you have left? It's just Richard Harris. That sounds grim. So anyway, thank you, Gothos. And then we're going to move on to Twitter, where I have to thank everybody for these people for retweeting the show. Again, it helps it get noticed when a new episode drops. So thanks to the following people: Firestorm Fan, Once Upon a Geek. Hey, I think those are the same guys. World Spine, C. Kale, Factory Mirror, It's Plastic Man, Max Romero. I think those are the same guys. Tim Price 17, Ryan Daly 01, Static Healing, BGSU, Batman Conference, Mick Jameson 1, Ron Mars. Hey, the Ron Mars. Cool. Comics in the Golden Age, Kyle Benning Art, Justice Trek, Big Five Army, Lay Asif, The Mind of Scott X, Siskoid, Brother Exani, and of course Plaid Stallions, who's Brian Heiler himself. So again, thanks everybody for the comments, and thanks for the retweeting. I really do appreciate it, getting the show out there. And like I said, I thank you once again to Brian Heiler for coming by to talk about Tarzan, and to thank, of course, my pal Chris Franklin to talk about coming back once again for the Christmas episode of Treasury Cast. So I guess that is going to do it, and that's going to do it for 2018. This is our final episode of the year. We will be back in January with kind of an unusual subject, because it's a pretty straightforward treasury, but it's something I'm not that familiar with, so we'll have to see how that goes. You'll find out in a couple of weeks when the episode drops. So again, thanks everybody for listening. I really appreciate all the comments and all the kind words about the show. I love doing Treasury Casts, and it's great that everybody seems to enjoy it. So have a great new year, everybody, and until the next episode, go big or go home.
Ah, holidays in New York. The lights, the snow, the music.
Those are some of the worst jingle bells I've ever heard.
Whoa! And there's the guilty party responsible for the music. Hold it right there, shocker!
Robbing a bank on Christmas Eve? That is lower than... Is there even a word for how low that is?
Just call me the Scrooge who shocked Christmas.
Yeah, no. I am not calling you that. My commu- communicator. Just for that, I'm gonna write a letter and tell Santa to put you on the naughty list. Or I could just knock you out. That way I don't have to write the letter. Cops will pick you up in a sec. Oh, and have a happy new year. In jail.